The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Halper.
I'm the second host, Aaron Matte. Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. It's great to have you with us for another week. The school year has begun, and let's see how many students are going to be muzzled this fall for speaking up for Palestine. That's kind of one of the big questions over this school year.
Yeah. Muzzled, arrested, physically attacked. Who knows?
Yeah.
So many choices for our repressive state apparatus to choose from.
And to throw in just more intrigue to the American school system, you also have to deal with regular school shootings, as we just saw in Georgia.
Oh, right.
So, you know, what a wild time. Anyway, welcome to fall. Welcome to Useful Idiots for another week. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there, support the show, and get bonus content.
Yeah. And for Democrats Suck, let's take a look at Jake Sullivan. You know, we have been obviously justifiably speaking a lot about Israel, Palestine, the genocide going on there, the United States complicity in it. But the United States is also complicit in other wars, and that includes the great proxy war between Russia and the United States, basically, that is being carried out in the war between Russia and Ukraine. Let's take a look at what Jake Sullivan had to say about what is happening in that region right now.
Yes, Keith Bradshaw for the New York Times. Have you made any progress with China in discussing what might be a possible resolution for the war in Ukraine? Thank you.
I can't say that we did make progress on that issue. The PRC has been very public in its view that the war should end through diplomacy. They've laid out various principles, both.
What a strange view.
I know.
For the PRC to lay out there. The war should end through diplomacy.
Yeah. The People's Republic of China is really weird.
Yeah. So rather than have two sides kill each other and grind each other down and sacrifice, you know, hundreds of thousands more people, they should talk, aka engage in diplomacy. And for Jake Sullivan, that's like some strange foreign concept. Like, that's like saying that, you know, like doctors have been very clear in their view that people should drink water, you know, to survive, you know.
Right.
You know, we all have different approaches to the world, and the U.S. approach includes being hostile to the concept of diplomacy. It's refreshing to see an admission.
I know. That's what I was thinking, actually. It is refreshingly honest to say, no, we're not making progress because obstacles like China attempting diplomacy are getting in the way of progress.
The Chinese have been very clear in their view that they don't want to see nuclear war.
Yeah.
We have a different opinion, but we respect our differences, and we understand that China has a different approach to the world. And that's what this world is all about, is, you know, living with people who don't share our views that diplomacy is bad and nuclear war is bad.
Different folks. Yeah. China must be thrilled that they're that he's unintentionally praising them
unilaterally and in a separate communication with the Brazilians. We had the opportunity to exchange views on the war against Ukraine over the course of the last 3 days. We didn't reach any particular plan with respect to diplomacy, in large part because the United States very rigorously adheres to the simple maxim of nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. So ultimately, it will be up to Ukraine to decide how it wants to proceed with diplomacy and negotiations.
Oh, what a truth teller Jake Sullivan is. Nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. They will not impose diplomacy on Ukraine. We know that the Biden administration really believes in Ukrainian sovereignty, which is why they got in the way of negotiations between Russia and Ukraine that could have, of course, ended this war and saved thousands of lives.
Yeah, look, Jake Sullivan omits And he's helped out in this by the U.S. media, which never talks about the fact that Russia and Ukraine negotiated a peace deal more than 2 years ago, back in April 2022. The premise was basically Ukraine would declare neutrality, which, contrary to people thinking that's some radical demand, that was actually enshrined in Ukraine's founding state constitution. So Russia was simply asking that Ukraine revert to its founding documents. And in exchange for that, Russia would withdraw to its pre-invasion lines, and there'd be some sort of arrangement worked out for Crimea and the Donbass, right? We all know what happened. The U.S. blocked that, or the U.S. opposed that. But even publicly, they said, like, they undermined Jake Sullivan's talking point that nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. Because, for example, Ukraine, back at this time when this deal was being negotiated, they asked the U.S. and other states for security guarantees to, like, underpin this agreement with Russia. And this was the U.S. and NATO's response, as captured by a headline at the time in the Washington Post. NATO says Ukraine to decide on peace deal with Russia within limits, okay? So what NATO was saying, and by NATO they mean the U.S., that there were limits on what the U.S. would allow Ukraine to decide to make peace. And those limits included that the U.S. was not going to basically let Ukraine make peace with Russia. So Jake Sullivan says nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, but that headline at the time was much more accurate because they're saying actually Ukraine can decide within limits. And basically those limits included not being allowed to make peace with Russia.
Nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine within limits is actually the policy.
That's exactly what it was. And we all forget that. Around that same time, in late March of 2022, NATO even got a hold of the draft peace treaty that was being negotiated between Ukraine and Russia. And there was a meeting in Brussels, which Joe Biden attended. And this is according to the New York Times. It came out recently. The president of Poland, Andrzej Duda, he held up a text of the proposed treaty. And he said, would any of you sign this? He was outraged that this treaty was being negotiated. And nobody in the room said yes. So they were basically saying that on Ukraine's behalf, they were going to reject the peace treaty that Ukraine was then negotiating. So this idea of nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine is it's a complete lie, because quietly behind the scenes, they all rejected the peace deal that Ukraine negotiated. And they've been helped along in their rejectionism, because U.S. media just never reports this stuff, or at least doesn't highlight it very loudly. And of course, if we get the truth, it comes out as recently happened with the New York Times more than 2 years later.
But it's not like there's any urgency to this. It's not like it could have saved lives.
Yeah, no. And you know, the latest news is from Ukraine. So, you know, Ukraine tried to leverage its invasion into Kursk, into Russia's Kursk region, by showing Biden, like, hey, look what we're doing to Putin. We're really humiliating him. Now, can we get your permission to use U.S. missiles for long range strikes into Russia?
Man.
And as has always been the case, first the Biden administration said no, right? We saw that before with the TACMs and cluster bombs and F-16s. And then Biden's like, you know what? Maybe things have changed a little bit. We'll reconsider. And now, according to Reuters just reported this week that actually, lo and behold, the Biden administration is likely going to give Ukraine this permission. So that's the latest step on the escalation ladder that we're onto now. And everyone's just kind of like, you know, no big deal.
So it's so great that the U.S. isn't diplomatically oriented the way China is.
Those Chinese that don't understand that diplomacy is
the enemy.
Yeah. War. So basically, like nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine means no diplomacy with Ukraine, only war with Ukraine. That's, I think, what that means in real life.
Right.
So thank you, Jake Sullivan, for laying it out.
Thank you for your partial honesty.
Okay. For Republicans suck, let's turn to J.D. Vance, the vice presidential nominee for Republicans. Not giving Trump, I think, the boost he expected out of J.D. Vance. I'm not sure what he thought in bringing in a senator who's like barely been elected to office, like, and doesn't have huge name recognition, and has some views I agree with when it comes to, for example, being critical of the proxy war in Ukraine. But domestically, man, not much, I think, to love. And he was asked about what can be done to curb the cost of daycare in the U.S. And this was his response.
can we do about lowering the cost of daycare? Hayden, obviously a working family, and it's very hard for working families to get by. How will we lower the cost of daycare?
Yeah, such an important question, Charlie. And I think one of the things that we can do is make it easier for family models to choose, or for families to choose whatever model they want, right? So one of the ways that you might be able to relieve a little bit of pressure on people who are paying so much for daycare is make it so that you know, maybe like grandma or grandpa wants to help out a little bit more, or maybe there's an aunt or uncle that wants to help out a little bit more. If that happens, you relieve some of the pressure on all the resources that we're spending in daycare.
All right, I didn't know this. So there are so many relatives who want to look after kids, but somehow the government is standing in the way. So if only grandma and grandpa knew from J.D. Vance that they have permission, I guess, to look after the kid, right. Then problem solved. Then we don't have to worry about daycare costs at all. Just
right.
Let's bring in grandma and grandpa or an uncle and aunt.
Yeah. I mean, people have never thought about this until J.D. Vance suggested it. He really thinks outside the box. People, if grandma and grandpa and aunt and uncle aren't already helping out, it's because they didn't hear this idea from J.D. Vance.
There we go. In fairness to J.D. Vance, in the clip, he goes on to say also we can increase access for people so they don't have to have such educational burdens, like such a high threshold of education to be able to look after kids. That's his other idea. So basically make it easier for people who want to be professionals in the daycare realm to do it rather than have such a high education burden. But how about, I don't know, doing something like universal pre-K, which is what happened in New York. And, you know, but I guess that's too communist for them. It's hard when you don't want to spend any money on social welfare programs, the box you put yourself in.
Right.
It's very difficult.
It really ties your hands.
Yeah. Yeah. Does anybody say that does anybody in New York say that universal pre-K has been a bad thing? It's got nothing but rave reviews that I've seen. I'd love to hear the argument against it if there is one. It seems like these programs work, where what you do is you invest state resources in services that help people and ease the burden on working people. And so they don't have to like worry about getting an extra job or whatever else. I mean, that seems to be the method that works. But if you're a Republican and you're allergic to social services, that's not an option.
Well, let's turn to Isn't That Weird? And I think that instead of setting this up, let's just turn to the videotape.
A professional soccer game was suspended in Norway when fans threw fish cakes and other objects onto the field to protest the use of a video assistant referee, or VAR. The Norwegian Eliteserien game between Rosenborg BK and Lillestrøm was initially stopped mere minutes after kickoff due to the fish cakes raining down on the field. Play eventually resumed, but fans from both sides continued to throw fish cakes and started adding tennis balls and smoke bombs into the mix. The game was officially suspended after just 32 minutes of play, with the score tied at 0-0. Some fans at the game were seen holding a banner, which read, "We will never give up. VAR will go away."
That is some impassioned activism right there. Never gonna give up, because video-assisted refereeing is, I guess, really problematic for sports fans. And I just want to give these people a shout out for not just going with fish cakes, but ramping it up to other weapons, stink bombs, for instance.
I mean, you know, this recalls for me Chomsky's observation that like sports diverts people's genuine need to be a part of a community and to be active and trying to improve their community. And it exploits that need by diverting it into completely useless endeavors, like being obsessed with sports outcomes and the way the rules, rather than being concerned about how the society is rigged against working people, they're obviously concerned about how the sports rules are rigged against their favorite team, which is has no obvious impact on their life.
Bread and
they
circuses.
Are passionate about it.
Bread and circus.
Yeah. Yeah. But they are passionate about it. I don't understand like what their beef is with VAR. I guess they feel as if it leads to delays in the game and wrong calls, but,
Well, actually, Wilson, let's play a couple more seconds of that video because they actually explain it.
Critics of VAR, which the league adopted in 2023, say the system leads to referees taking too much time to make decisions, bringing games to long halts in the meantime. The game is expected to be rescheduled.
It sounds like these fans have an attention problem where they just can't sit still with their own thoughts for a few extra minutes
right.
while the referee is making the decision. So what I would say is a solution is the players on the field need to throw Ritalin and other ADD medications back into the right. crowd.
Yeah, I was going to say they should try some mindfulness exercise. Mm,
okay, there we go. Yeah, yeah. So or throw mindfulness.
The audience. Yeah.
Yeah, throw mindfulness tapes and audiobooks
right.
into the crowd as well. You know, I'm yeah. not advocating drug distribution.
Right. Yeah. No. He retracts. Aaron retracts
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Yeah. Mindfulness is a much safer approach.
Yeah. But I mean, it's, you know, let him eat cake, let him eat fish cake. That works well too. So, yeah. So what do we got for Isn't That Terrible, Aaron?
For Isn't That Terrible, the Russians are at it again. We have a new allegation of Russian interference. And I will say this, you know, I've been very critical of Russiagate. I think it was a complete scam, the whole collusion, Trump-Russia thing. That was obviously a ridiculous conspiracy theory that was shown to be a hoax. Also, the Russian interference aspect of that also was, I think, a massive scam as well. But this time, actually, I do think they've caught the Russians doing something. And it's both terrible and funny. Here's the headline. U.S. government accused an unnamed Tennessee-based company of being funded by Russian operatives as part of an influence operation. The company is called Watch Tenet Now, or just Tenet. And it's linked to right-wing commentators such as Tim Kass, Tim Pool, and Benny Johnson, also Dave Rubin. And look, if the allegations in the indictment are correct, it actually does look like Russia, the state broadcaster RT, did engage in a covert influence operation where basically they paid something like $10 million to this Tennessee company called Tenet, which is set up by a couple of right-wing pundits, and disguised themselves as being like Americans when really the money was coming from Russia. And they paid this company millions of dollars to produce content from people like Tim Pool and Dave Rubin and Benny Johnson. If the indictment is correct, I'm going to assume that it is. So it actually does look like Russia, for once, did engage in an influence operation. And of course, this has everybody who bought into Russiagate screaming vindication. The Russians are at it. A few problems, though. First of all, let's look at some of the content that this channel Tenet put out featuring people like Dave Rubin. This is a few examples collected by Mike Tracy. FatCon Seattle, celebrate obesity with like-minded embodied people, Dave Rubin. So Dave Rubin's making fun of like, you know,
healthy at any size type of mentality.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's one example. Is there anything you respect about Democrats with Dave Rubin? Okay. Education indoctrination, former leftist condemns woke curriculum. And by the way, look at the view counts on these. Like, this is 8 months old, only 1,000 views. Like,
damn.
For Dave Rubin, who's supposed to be a big influencer on the right, not much there.
Whoa.
Like 1,000 views. Anyway, so
kind of encouraging. I'm actually very heartened by that, by his low view numbers. Yeah.
So similar to previous, like, you know, Russia-based influence operations or troll accounts, this doesn't seem to have been very successful. And again, the content really has nothing to do with the core Russiagate claims that this is all about helping Trump and sowing chaos. It just sounds like Russia, for some reason, decided to buy off some right-wing commentators and hope that that would give them an audience that they could leverage for, right. you know. But it just doesn't seem to have been very successful. And again, $10 million.
I'd ask for my money back if I were Russia.
It's a lot of money they pay these people. Now, it's true that some of these people, you know, like Tim Pool, has from like a right-wing perspective been skeptical of Ukraine funding. But it's like, it's not coming from a very, like, there's not much of a critique there of the national security state and of right. using Ukraine for a disastrous proxy war. And for right. undermining all the peace opportunities that existed. It's more just from like, why America are we spending first. Our money on this? America
yeah.
first. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I want to say that there are multiple levels of terrible in this. Isn't That Terrible? Obviously, it's terrible what's happening, what the United States is doing. But, you know, it's a meta terrible because I would say Tim Pool and Dave Rubin are also terrible.
Yeah. Well, you know, Dave Rubin, especially, I know as being just a unhinged anti-Palestinian bigot. Yeah. And, he's insulted me before on Twitter. Yeah. He's insulted you, I think, too.
Yeah.
I mean, so no love here for Dave Rubin.
Right.
Tim Pool.
We're principled.
Tim Pool's show, you know, remember when I got.
You did go on it.
Remember when I was, you know, I had my train encounter with Chris right. Coons? Well, that was on my way to go do the Tim Pool show at his compound in suburban Maryland, I think. And yeah, I did that. And, you know, we kind of agreed. I mean, basically, we agreed that Russiagate was a scam. But then the rest of the show was him, like, he was talking about how, like, homeless people basically want to, sorry, unhoused people just want to be unhoused. And there's nothing we can do to help them. That was basically his argument. Right. And I was like, all right. What's funny, it's like, first of all, what I find so funny here is like, okay, someone comes to you with an offer of like millions of dollars for you to produce a couple of videos a week, and you don't do any, obviously they didn't do any real scrutiny of who these people were trying to pay them. Because that's a lot of money to produce just a couple of videos about, like, you know, woke, like just woke bashing and all the typical right-wing stuff. So that's funny. And then it's also funny, like what, to the extent Russia was involved in this, and it does look like this comes from RT, Russia State Television, like, what did Russia hope to gain out of this by spending so much money? And if you're a Russian, is this how you want your, like, tax money to be used, to, like, pay some, like, right-wing influencers a lot of money to, like, make videos about, like, making fun of, like, woke culture? It just seems like it's just funny. And, like, did Russia also not – did the Russians involved in this not think that they're going to not get caught? I mean, it's really – it's a really hard thing to pull off. And Russia's done this before. Like, they've tried to put out these media outlets, pretend as if they're independent. There's an outlet called Redfish a few years ago that was, like, on Twitter and social media. And Russia basically tried to conceal that RT was behind it. But, of course, like you can't hide stuff like that. So was the aim – I don't know. Did they really think they could get away with it? And also, it's like, you have to wonder, was the aim to, like, discredit these right-wing influencers?
Because it does make them look really stupid.
You know, I don't know. It's hard to figure out.
This would be interesting if this were like a left wing Russian plot.
All I do know is that because some Russians were caught doing this, those who pushed Russiagate for years. And again, Russiagate was not just this allegation that, like, Russia has, like, covert influence operations on social media. It was that Russia engaged in a sprawling conspiracy to elect Donald Trump the president and was directly conspiring with Trump and his campaign through blackmail and financial leverage and all these things. It was like the biggest conspiracy theory, the dumbest conspiracy theory, I think, ever in the U.S. And everybody bought into it. And now those who pushed that are claiming, because of this one indictment, it's completely vindicated. So here, for example, is Joe Scarborough of Morning Joe.
To the same people that get out, a lot of them, that get out and talk about the Russian hoax. Oh, there's a Russian. Oh, there's no, come on. What are you talking about? There's no connection between, you know, this and Russia. And Russia's not trying to do, but always apologizing for.
So notice how Joe there doesn't say, he doesn't specify what position he's critiquing. He's making fun of people who, just to paraphrase him, he says, who say there's no connection between Trump and this. He doesn't say with any specificity what is the connection is, and because he knows actually the connection was between Trump and Russia, which was the core conspiracy theory he pushed and his network pushed for years and years and years. But now he's not saying between Russia and Trump because he knows that it actually is a moronic conspiracy theory.
Right.
He's pretending as if this indictment vindicates everything that he's now not trying to specify because he knows actually it's a scam.
Reminds me of when I was in high school and a history teacher encouraged me to not say just this. Like, I had to say this what? The evidence shows this. This what? What's the this? There's no this there. There's no there there. Joe Scarborough, there's no there this there.
Yeah. Your high school teacher was inadvertently ruining your chances of becoming an MSNBC host, because if you are on MSNBC now, you don't want to acknowledge that you pushed a conspiracy theory that Trump was controlled by Vladimir Putin for, you know, 6 years.
True.
Well, let's hear a little bit more.
Russia always apologizing for Putin, always claiming that Vladimir Putin is not the bad guy, that Zelensky's actually the bad guy, like the historian who said, oh, Churchill's the bad guy in World War II, not Adolf Hitler. Like, this has been going on for years. The kids call it gaslighting. And now we found out at least a few of these who are just straight on working for the Russian government, again, either knowingly or unknowingly.
Well, in fact, according to the indictment, it was unknowingly. The indictment does paint, you know, Tim Pool and these guys as being unknowing of the fact that they were being duped by Russians. And again, while some of them do have overlapping views with Russia, the majority of the content here was about like just typical right wing media stuff, like making fun of woke people. And again, even if every word in the allegation is true, I'm sorry, Joe, it doesn't validate your insane conspiracy theories for years and years and years that Russia was brainwashing millions of Americans to vote for Donald Trump and to be skeptical of fueling a proxy war in Ukraine. This is just one indictment of that entails a few right-wing influencers and about $10 million, which is a drop in the bucket compared to what, for example, AIPAC spends every year to influence U.S. elections and actually sees results. Because it, you know, rather than just like getting some right-wingers to produce some content, AIPAC is able to spend enough money to oust elected members of Congress. That's actual influence. And that's never something you'll hear complained about on MSNBC.
Right. We invite you to cover that, Joe. Please do. That would be great.
And those have been your four basic food groups.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly one in three American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today.
Today's guest is Sarit Mikhaeli, who is the international advocacy lead for B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. And I wanted to start off, before we get to the interview, I just wanted to show a tweet that was written by B'Tselem that I think speaks to the moment right now. Israel is killing the hostages in Gaza one by one. The six Israeli hostages whose bodies were recovered from Gaza this morning could have been saved if the Israeli government had heeded the pleas of their families and the Israeli public to reach a ceasefire and an exchange deal. The Israeli government places no value on human life, whether of its Gazan subjects or its own citizens. And here is Sarit Mikhaeli. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
So you guys at B'Tselem have done such important work documenting human rights violations on the ground. There's so much to cover, unfortunately, because there are human rights violations all over Palestine right now. Wanted to start off, though, with asking you about what is happening right now in the West Bank.
Okay, in terms of the situation in the West Bank at the moment, it seems that Israel is pretty much transferring its different tactics and modus operandi from Gaza to the West Bank. We are in the midst now of the largest military operation that Israel has conducted in many years now in the northern West Bank, ostensibly to deal with terror. But what it is doing on the ground is destroying infrastructure. It's going into the Jenin, the Tulkarem refugee camps, and essentially basically like pulling out the roads, just creating like utter disruption. Homes are being demolished. People have left. Israel is assessing that thousands of residents of the Jenin refugee camp have left their homes. There's a creation of this new wave of internal refugees within the West Bank. Needless to say, this also involves the killing of many Palestinians. Israel claims they are militants. Research that we need to do into this to assess and to look into the circumstances. It does appear that many of the people killed have been armed, and there were some people who were also killed within an exchange of gunfire. But there also there was an 84-year-old person killed, a person with learning disabilities, and generally the destruction that has been happening and been inflicted by the Israeli security forces is something that people are describing as the gasification of the West Bank. This is what the Israeli army is doing. But then the other branch of the Israeli government, Israeli settlers, are using their own form of intense violence to hound Palestinian herding communities out of their homes. And this morning we heard that another small community in the northern Jordan Valley has succumbed to this type of settler harassment and violence and threats and decided to leave their homes because for the past weeks they've been dealing with this intense harassment with no protection from the Israeli authorities. And this, maybe I should just say, this community in the northern Jordan Valley is adding to about 19 entire Palestinian herder communities that have been forcibly transferred from their homes since the war began, since October 7th.
Well, you at B'Tselem put out a video that's extremely disturbing. Rape in the Name of God is the title of it. And this shows a group of settlers harassing Palestinians in the South Hebron Hills. And as we're going to hear, one of the settlers mentioned Sde Tamon, the Sde Tamon Center, which is, of course, where Palestinian prisoners were tortured and raped by Israeli guards. So let's take a look at this video.
Next time someone touches him, my cow.
Why your cows came here?
Why, guys? Because this is my land.
But this is my house.
I was given it by God.
Shame,
and Abraham,
shame,
Isaac,
shame,
Yaakov.
Shame, shame. Hey,
shut no, the fuck up.
This is
run
my house.
Not your
this
house.
This is okay. No. That's your house.
Yeah.
Okay, you
can't. You crazy witch to go to fuck the house. Let's go.
Where?
Let's go right now.
Show what you phone. What you want.
Well, I want to dance with you, man.
Dance with me?
I want to dance with you. You look.
I'm not your bitch.
You look sweet. You are my bitch. And you look sweet, you know? You look so fresh, so sweet.
I'll
be happy to sit with you in a jail someday. I will be happy. You know Sde Tamon? Sde Tamon? Honestly, Shem Shammai, what's your name, man? Tambin? Man in the bear?
I mean, the fact that this was recorded.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a few things about this. The first is just the utter sense of impunity that these Israeli settlers clearly have, and for a good reason, because they do actually, it's not just a sense of impunity. they have impunity. Nothing is going to be done to them under the current government, the current regime. Not that much was done in previous governments, but under the Ben-Gvir police takeover, the Israeli police have clarified they're simply not going to do anything to stop settlers from this harassment, this intimidation. So that's the first thing I think you can see in this video. The second thing I think that is probably a bit more complicated to understand, unless you've been on the ground, is that there is this big mixture between just very aggressive, I would say, according to my personal assessment, sadistic kind of activities, actions, urges, hateful urges. It's all mixed up with this whole Jewish supremacy kind of guided and very religious and very messianic perspective. And I'm not saying that this is in any way belittling the political, the systematic, and the very much the government sponsored aspects of settler violence. But there's also this additional, just terrible, violent and very pleased and joyful sort of violence that is now happening, and that is really just blighting the lives of these Palestinian communities. This is one example that is especially egregious because of all of these, also this horrific sexual harassment and these very sexually aggressive and violent undertones. But these are things that were happening, we're hearing again and again from settlers on the ground. The objectives in the West Bank are taking over as much land as possible, pushing Palestinians away from the rural areas in order that they can then be taken over and exploited by Israeli settlements, by Israel. That's been the objective for decades. But the horrors of October 7th and also the lack of any sort of focus on the West Bank, the lack of interest of most Israelis and also probably of the international community, the lack of bandwidth, I also think, are enabling Israel and the settlers working hand in glove to really further this objective and to push forward irreversible changes that are harming both Palestinians as a collective, but also these individual Palestinian communities.
We also have video of Netanyahu, who appeared on television and showed a map. And this map totally erases the West Bank. Let's take a look at this image. He's not even hiding this literal ethnic cleansing. Can you comment on the significance of his showing this on television?
I have to say that on Israeli television, if you look at mainstream Israeli images, you wouldn't be particularly surprised by this image. You know, it's been in the recent, prominence that the phrase "from the river to the sea" has gotten, supposedly as expressing anti-Semitism and expressing a kind of desire to wipe out Israel and the danger, the alleged danger of this desire. But whereas in actual fact, what is happening now between the river to the sea is full Israeli control over all of the land, with Israel having created these very distinct kind of like areas based on the, you know, different criteria, and certainly has created distinct categories of Palestinians, all of them inferior to myself as an Israeli Jew in terms of the access to rights. But each Palestinian also has this distinct area. But Israel and the Israeli regime controls the entire area. So in a way, from the river to the sea is the reality that we're existing under right now, except that it's a reality of apartheid. It's a reality of Jewish supremacy. Israeli mainstream discourses, and this can be viewed again and again in many different, maps. There was just this week a new map issued by the Israeli Ministry of Education that did something very similar also. There's like a tiny erasure. There's a certain very, very small, unclear dotted line that connotes the West Bank. But primarily, you see Palestinian enclaves in a sea of Israeli territory, right? And that's also the way Israel's current Israeli government's perception of the future and any sort of possibility of any sort of sovereignty between the river and the sea is phrased, is actually put in writing in the founding document of the current Israeli government, right? There is no room for any sovereignty other than Jewish sovereignty between the river and the sea. That's, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting exactly. This is how Israelis are brought up to think. And then when most Israelis don't really think of the West Bank as occupied, don't really view the occupied territories as being occupied, it's for a good reason, because there is a vast governmental investment in denying this sort of information from Israelis, for example, in the education system. That's not to say that the information is not available, but the wiping out, the blurring of the Green Line is a very long term policy of the Israeli government. It's expressed in a lot of our kind of daily conversations here in Israel. So I'm not surprised that Netanyahu has erased the West Bank. From the perspective of Netanyahu, the West Bank is under full Israeli control, except that there's kind of like this counter argument, which is that actually the Palestinian Authority have some form of self-rule in these tiny enclaves. And that is essentially another one of the Israeli kind of like arguments that are used to justify our full control over everywhere. But because the mere existence of the Palestinian Authority is utilized as a kind of a counter argument to demonstrate essentially that Palestinians are not occupied, right? That they're actually living in some sort of independence, which is, of course, an absolute lie.
Yeah, I mean, the Palestinian Authority has accomplished what? There are some VIPs that get special treatment. They don't have to go through checkpoints like in the Palestinian Authority. And they do employ a lot of people. So there are a lot of people in the West Bank who rely on the PA for their jobs. But aside from that, in terms of protecting anybody, for example, from the latest Israeli assaults on places like Jenin, Palestinian Authority is nowhere to be found. And there's a lot of frustration against them in the West Bank because of it. What do you think Israel's goal is in the West Bank? Is it similar to Gaza, to push out as many people as possible? Like, are they expecting, or are they trying to encourage another exodus of Palestinians?
I don't know that there's one concrete, coherent goal. I think there are many goals. And if you speak to people like Smotrich, who very maybe usefully for us wrote down the exact objective that he has in his plan, which is to remove all Palestinians from anywhere between the river and the sea. But if you're talking to more mainstream people in the Israeli settler movement or the Israeli right, when you think about their plans, it's not 100% coherent. And I often think that plans are often, and this is my analysis, of course, the plans are based on what is realistically achievable at any given moment. 2 years ago, if you'd have spoken to settler leaders, they would not dream in their wildest dreams that they'd be able to forcibly remove so many Palestinian herding communities from their land so quickly and easily. I think before 2016, you would have probably not been able, the assessment of what is, before Trump's election, the assessment of what is realistic was probably different. So, and when you listen, for example, to Orit Struk recently, I'm not sure you followed her statement about feeling like she lives in a miraculous time, right? She's a government minister, the minister of essentially settlement. It's very clear that she did not expect this quote unquote miracle to happen very soon. This, by the way, is a miracle when, you know, tens of thousands of Israeli citizens, I'm not even talking about Gazans, have been evacuated from their homes, when thousands of Israelis have been injured and 1,200 Israelis killed on October 7th. That is a miraculous period for the Israeli messianic far right, because it enables all of this settlement expansion. It enables so many things in the West Bank. I mean, I'll give you one example. Last year, the olive harvest fell, or the annual olive harvest starts at about 15th of October. So really days after October 7th and the beginning of the war, there was also the beginning of the olive harvest. And almost all Palestinians in the West Bank were not able to harvest some of their crops. The assessment is that 50% of the crops were not harvested last year. And that was because of, again, due to the very concerted and coordinated campaign by settlers and the army to stop people from reaching their olive groves in order to harvest. This is something, you know, this is them utilizing an opportunity to, you know, a devastating effect. I don't see, by the way, how we're arriving at any sort of new dynamic this year. And remember, in just over a month, people are going to try and reach and access their olive trees again throughout the West Bank, with the same issues still plaguing them. Settlers organized in these like paramilitary groups with the blessing of the Israeli army, many of them carrying weapons provided by the army, many of them part of these rapid response units. A lot of Israelis have also received guns and weapons from Ben-Gvir. So all of these things still happening on the ground. And I would say that they will go as far as they can. Many of them are fantasizing openly, none of this is secret, about removing all of the Palestinians over, you know, the river to Jordan. But I'm not saying that this is on the cards. What I am saying is that the current reality that we're dealing with in the West Bank is getting closer and closer. It's looking closer and closer, what we've been seeing in Gaza. And if you had told me a year ago that Israel would be able to empty the northern Gaza Strip from almost all of its inhabitants, to demolish almost all of the infrastructure in that area, we probably wouldn't have believed it ourselves. So we need to be very cautious, and we have to also accept that the international community has been absolutely, you know, has simply not stepped up to their role in thwarting these kinds of Israeli actions.
And I'm going to ask you more about the international community in a second, but returning to the issue of sexual violence and rape, I want to ask you about the report that B'Tselem put out last month, Welcome to Hell. And could you explain why it's called Welcome to Hell and also summarize the findings of the report?
Yeah, it's called Welcome to Hell because this is what a jailer, an Israeli prison service worker, told one of our witnesses when they entered the jail, the prison. The report essentially looks at the testimonies of Palestinian prisoners who have been either detained after October 7th or detained before, but experienced the kinds of conditions post-October 7th in the Israeli prison system. We're not talking about Sdetiman, right? In a way, paradoxically, we only spoke to people who Israel did not think of as very dangerous terrorists, quote unquote, because they were all released. We interviewed them after they were released, some were, most without actually facing any sort of trial. Maybe they might have been administrative detainees, they might have been arrested, kept for days or weeks and then released. And some of them are actually people who served their sentences. But the majority were not tried, didn't face any proper real trial. And they gave the most gruesome accounts that are very consistent, even though they came from different prisons and different towns, and none of them have been in touch with one another in any systematic way. They gave accounts that demonstrate the systemic nature of what has been happening in the Israeli prison system. And the way we summed it up is that after October 7th, Israel turned the prison system that deals with Palestinians into a network of torture camps, because the treatment that these Palestinians have faced in that period amounts to torture in many of the cases, in some cases amounts to abuse, and it includes the whole range of these abusive practices like overt violence, intense violence, beatings, and also humiliations and terrible conditions, horrific both kind of living conditions and also any sort of ability to maintain a sort of daily routine or any sort of hygiene has been destroyed. Starvation as a policy, literally, people are losing 10 and 20 kilo of their weight when they're released because they're not able to eat enough. And also just, a denial of medical treatment, a denial of sleep, all of these horrific conditions. And the most important thing I would say is that none of this is the result of individual actions by any sort of individual prison guard. These are systemic actions inspired by Minister Ben-Gvir again.
Right. So they're not, this is not a couple of bad apples or rogue agents. This is systemic.
Absolutely. The sheer fact that so much of this has been described by so many Palestinians that have been released from prison, who, as I said, were in different detention centers in different periods and in different areas and come and live in different areas, but described such similar policies is really crucial. The other really horrific thing is that Israel actually admits to some of it, but boasts that some of this is correct. Now, I want to be clear. Israel hasn't said, oh, we're starving prisoners, oh, we're beating them up or anything of that sort. But Minister Ben-Gvir has essentially boasted change or the deterioration in the prison conditions as an achievement, right? So obviously they're very careful about saying that everything is done within the framework of the law. We would disagree. We would say it's absolutely illegal and a violation of international law. But many of these things, like the canceling of any possibility of Palestinians to hold any sort of personal items or buy additional food even from the prison canteen, all of these things have been stated openly by Israel, by official Israeli spokespeople.
And we know that the Stay Tamon violence and rape has been actually deemed as legitimate by a member of the Knesset who said out loud in front of the entire Knesset that it was legitimate to insert sticks into someone's rectum.
I mean, look, I it's really one of the most depressing and hopeless periods in any sort of living memory. And I've lived here, all my life or barring certain periods. I don't remember a worse period in Israel. So many horrific things and so many red lines or things that we would have been up in arms about even a year ago, as I said, are just, people are just becoming so normalized. One of them is that just the callous approach to such horrors and all of this justified by the horrors perpetrated by Hamas. Instead of saying these are absolute horrors, these are crimes that no one should be perpetrating, many Israelis are saying, oh, well, we'll do the same. It's justified because what was done to us. We cannot accept this. B'Tselem has been really just on the front lines, I think, of demanding, an end to this just moral abyss. But certainly we're a tiny minority right now in Israeli society. Things are changing a little bit, I think. I think some people are beginning to wake up from this really, horrific, I think, just... this orgy of hate and revenge that Israeli society was plunged into. But not all. You still hear the same sort of rhetoric that, it's unconscionable. And Israelis would immediately complain about it if it came from any other source in the world. It would be absolutely, denounced as the worst kinds of anti-Semitism. But it's deemed reasonable when it comes to Palestinians here.
The International Court of Justice recently handed down an advisory opinion on Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And it was pretty unequivocal. It said the state of Israel's continued presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. Israel is under an obligation to bring to an end its unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territory as rapidly as possible. Israel is under an obligation to cease immediately all new settlement activities and to evacuate all settlers from the occupied Palestinian territory. your thoughts on the significance of this ruling, and as a human rights group working in Israel, you know, can you do something with this? Does this, you know, bolster the case against Israel at all in any kind of legal forum, or is this just yet another ruling that the world will basically ignore?
Well, I think both, you know, both could be correct. The case against Israeli, I would say against the Israeli government, against the Israeli regime, or the Israeli human rights violations is absolutely bolstered by this. It's also, we have to be mindful that it's, even though it's the foremost legal instance on these issues in the world and should be viewed as a binding decision, it's not. It's an advisory opinion, and it's already been clarified to us by many governments that this is an advisory opinion. However, I do think there's two things from our, I mean, there's many things, obviously, but there's two things maybe to mention right now. The first is that there are many international fora, and there are also many governments who do respect the ICJ as a really important part of the rules-based world order. I know it sounds like a cliche these days, but you know, it's still something that we should continue to enhance and bolster, because it's in many ways it's the only protection that people have against tyranny, and especially against international human rights violations, like in a war, in an armed conflict. So there are different places where this will matter, and where governments can be confronted, and also different institutions like the United Nations institutions, and there should be an ongoing challenge to the status quo in these institutions. And the advisory opinion is very important on that level, because it ends a certain legal debate that has not really been a real legal debate. I mean, the illegality of the settlement was known to Israel since a few months after the beginning of the occupation, because there is an advisory opinion, or there's actually more like a legal opinion by Theodor Meron, who was then the legal advisor of the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. All of this is long, well-known and established facts, saying that that settling in the occupied territories would violate Article 49 of the Geneva Convention. So Israel knew it in real time. It chose, and it still chooses, to violate the law. But it is important to have this final, you know, final stamp on the illegality of the settlement and the occupation regime, and also on apartheid in the West Bank in some parts of the ruling. But there's also another issue, which is, I think, the moral issue and also the political issue, which is that up until now, there's been a very useful excuse for the international community to avoid action. And that excuse was grounded in a sort of, well, you know, there's these ongoing legal debates about this issue, and we need to reach some sort of agreed decision. Well, here's your agreed decision. There is no room any longer for, you know, kind of like foot dragging on this issue. Another question, or another kind of like counter argument that I've heard personally, and a lot of my colleagues, and I'm sure you've heard it as well over many years, is that, you know, the issues should be resolved within the framework of a diplomatic process or in a peace deal. And I think it's become clear now that this advisory opinion at least puts an end to the notion that there is somehow, you know, it's okay to continue this illegal, this very, very violent, cruel occupation, while at the same time talking and paying lip service, I would say, to some future diplomatic agreement that would lead to the establishment of a two-state solution and end the problems. That is just like, that argument can no longer, in my reading, right, in our position at B'Tselem, can no longer be used to stall effective action that will get Israel to comply with this advisory opinion. And of course, it's not an easy thing to do. Look at what's going on in Gaza. Israel has not complied with requests by the international community to and not even with requests by the United States of America, our biggest funder and enabler. So, you know, I'm not saying it's an easy, not describing this as anything that could be easy, but it just really reiterates the need to have real action that will actually get Israeli policymakers to change course, be it criminal accountability, like, for example, the ICC's or the ICC chief prosecutor's request for arrest warrants, but also diplomatic accountability, economic accountability, a whole range of different tools are now available to the international community, and they need to use them to get Israeli policymakers to change.
Yeah, it's interesting when you brought up the international community. One of the things that I wanted to point out is the way that the United States has obviously enabled Israel. And I'm going to quote one of the Palestinians who you guys interviewed in for your Welcome to Hell report. They put cigarettes out in my mouth and on my body. They put clamps on my testicles that were attached to something heavy. It went on like that for a whole day. My testicles swelled up and my left ear bled. Then a journalist asked Matthew Miller of the State Department about the rapes and sexual violence committed against Palestinians. And his response was basically, Israel should investigate itself.
Going back to Israel, Israeli media today released a video showing Israeli soldiers raping a Palestinian detainee at Sadi Tamim detention camp. The footage was very disturbing. I know you have commented on the reports about this detention center before, but we now have a new evidence, which is video. Have you seen that video, and do you have anything to say on that, and also the reports of, you know, rape in Israeli prisons?
So we have seen the video, and reports of sexual abuse of detainees are horrific. They ought to be investigated fully by the government of Israel, by the IDF.
And B'Tselem actually responded to that, because I think it has become abundantly clear over the years, with every year again and again, and now I don't know whether we even need to explain it any longer, that Israel is not going to investigate itself. It's unwilling and unable, in the words of the Rome Statute. It's unwilling because there is simply no capacity, both in terms of the actual investigations, it's just not possible, but also in this current political climate. Can you even imagine Israeli investigators really holding accountable Israeli officials for anything? I mean, it's absurd. And I have to say that we need not just the United States, although the United States is the most important player in this, but we need other international actors, the European Union, its member states, like-minded countries in the West, to begin to acknowledge that the Israeli system isn't going to provide accountability, and that it's just this knee-jerk reaction of just saying, well, we need an investigation. But B'Tselem's demonstrated again and again that these investigations are nothing but a very elaborate whitewash. I think we made that case very well, and it led us, at least in 2016, to stop referring cases to the investigative bodies, because we reached the conclusion that, as I said, that they function as a whitewash mechanism, not as a real mechanism to hold Israeli officials accountable. But I think now, when we have a government that is led by people who are openly, you know, inciting to racism and inciting to violence, and also openly saying that they're never going to arrest or hold any Israeli soldier or border police officer or police officer accountable, then I think the case is clear. And then you have just so much of this foot dragging and additional red tape that is being pushed forward, for example, by the different kind of briefs that have been provided to the ICC by different countries, including the United States, that isn't even part of the ICC, just in order to either get Israel off the hook or buy time until the decision of the pre-trial chamber about these arrest warrants. And this is, again, this is unacceptable. There needs to be an understanding that you cannot have a a system like the ICC, for example, which is only being applied to, I don't know, to African dictators. It's just not acceptable. And I think when I say that our kind of outreach on this issue is primarily to the West, that's because countries in the global South are actually angry and furious about this this reality where Israeli policymakers are receiving, you know, a totally different, you know, set of conditions or when it comes to the holding of this country, of Israel, accountable in the ICC. I think the credibility of the court and of all of the countries that are part of it is really at stake here. It's not just about Israeli policymakers, Gallant and Netanyahu.
You responded to a tweet by Kamala Harris the other day. I'm going to show the Kamala Harris tweet and then your response to that. Today, POTUS and I met with the U.S. hostage deal negotiation team. The murder of Hirsch Goldberg Polin and five other hostages was a brutal, barbaric act by Hamas terrorists. As POTUS said, Hamas leaders will pay for these crimes. It's long past time for a ceasefire and hostage deal. We need to bring the hostages home and end the suffering in Gaza. And you responded, Netanyahu is working for a Trump victory and will not willingly give Biden-Harris the win of a ceasefire and hostage deal. The only way to achieve this objective is through enough U.S. pressure to force Netanyahu's hand. So can you elaborate on this tweet and what you're saying there?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Well, another depressing interview about the world's worst crisis. It's very grim, but, you know, in any sad situation, you have to look for rays of light. And certainly activists like Sarit doing the work on the ground to expose the Israel occupation. It's a very positive thing. And, you know, I may have some points of disagreement about the nature of Israel and whether, like, what can you do with a state like this, which is just so consumed with supremacy and has nuclear weapons. I mean, can this state even be reformed? I hope it can, but it's very, very grim. But I'm very grateful to people like Sarit doing the work to expose the reality, because without them, so many of these crimes would just never be known. Right. So it's very, very important what B'Tselem does.
And definitely go to usefulidiotspodcast.com to see the full interview with Sarit, where she reacts to a very disturbing podcast called Two Nice Jewish Boys, which they're not nice at all. And I think it really speaks to a level of societal rot that we're seeing in Israel right now.
All right. Well, we hope you've enjoyed this episode. We thank you so much for joining us and for being a supporter, which again, you can do at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.